Welcome back to a special Christmas edition of Classical Guitar Insider. I don't know how special it is, but it is sponsored by Savage Classical. And I just actually had an email from somebody asking me a lot of questions about what kind of guitar to buy, and I couldn't really answer his question well. So I sent him over to Richard because I trust Richard. He's someone that I've never had any trouble dealing with financially, and I'm sure you won't either. He's a straight shooter, and more importantly, he's a generous person. So, you know, he's not out there to make any more than he thinks he should. So go out there to Savage Classical. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. And I just sort of steered it over to Richard, steered the question over to him. What should you spend? You know, I from what I understand, $7,000 is sort of the beginning base rate for a guitar that that may be played by someone who's giving concerts. Am I right about that? You can write me and let me know what you think. All right. Anyway, so I chose this episode, Scott Schwartz and Paul Warnick, to be the year-end, the Christmas episode. I chose it because, you know, we're talking about the Grand Littar, invented by Letitia Candle. You know, it seems like around the maybe in the 20s or the 30s, something like that. And Scott and Paul are, Paul Warnick is actually a slide guitar aficionado. I think he builds them. I haven't listened to the episode since we did it, but Paul is actually, you know, he deals with the nuts and bolts. And Scott is the resident instrument historian at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, University of Illinois, Elnora Guitar Festival, which also sponsors the show. So Scott, I felt like this was the most Christmassy one that I could do. I know we had two episodes back-to-back of non-classical guitarists. We had, I think we had John Tavius, and then we had Chris and Julian. But there's definitely, certainly a classical sweep to what Chris and Julian do. So I don't feel so bad about not having a classical guitarist, a pure classical guitarist on right out of the gate. And also, I don't have that many interviews backed up. I got a lot of these. I had some options. I kind of shat the bed a little bit when it came. I interviewed an old friend and a great, great guitarist, Connie Hsu, who I've known from New York, and now she's in Los Angeles. She's doing work for the Guitar Foundation of America. And I don't know what happened. That interview is going to, I'm going to have to edit it because I did a horrible job. I apologize to her. She came all the way out to Brooklyn. It was great seeing her. But I just, for whatever reason, was distracted, tired, and just could not, for the life of me, think about what to ask her. This is a much better interview. This is a much more dynamic one that I gave. I felt like I was a little more on my game. And also, you know, we're talking about building things. Building, I don't know, something about building things out of wood and elves and Christmas and stuff. I don't know, it all kind of fit together. It fit together as much as an interview that was conducted in the summer can fit into a year-end Christmas episode. So I was going to put her on, but I have to do a little more work with it, and I wanted to make sure and get something out. And then the next episode is episode 100. So this is episode 99, and the next one is the 100th episode. Now, there's a lot of ideas about what... there's not a lot. There's actually the idea that I'm getting from friends who love me and don't mind my voice, have told me that someone should interview me. And the question is, so the episode would be episode 100, as if you don't know enough about me already, just sitting here rambling every week, 100 episodes of, you know, sometimes 20 minutes of rambling in some of them. I feel like you should know me, but maybe there's some questions that people can ask. I don't know, but that's sort of been the idea, is that on the 100th episode, I am the guest. Either my really good friend, he doesn't want to say best friend. I mean, we say it sometimes. He said it depends on what mood he's in. I mean, I'm very loving, so I will call people my best friend. But he wants to interview me, Mike. And we used to do a podcast together, Brett and Mickey Watch Commercials, which is just a raunchy podcast where we just watch commercials and talk about them. I thought it was the most genius idea in the world. And then he said he couldn't do it because he works for an advertising company. So it was just us watching commercials, and we would comment on them. I would sort of be the Joe on the street, and he would be the resident expert, advertising industry expert. And in his defense, you're really not supposed. It's a very secretive industry. It's like the CIA for commerce. So he had to pull out. And so that's when I started this. But he wants to interview me, and he's got a great voice, and he's very funny. So I think I might let him do it. Or we could even do Simon Powis could do it. Or my friend Tony Landman, if you haven't checked out his podcasts. He's got a couple of them. So Tony Landman, I might have do it, but that would be over Skype. Mike and Simon would be in town. So it might be a little bit of a break before we get back to this, because I want to produce a good one. I want 100 to be special. And so even if it's not me being interviewed, maybe I can get something with like Elliot Fisk or something. I want it to be, I don't want to just throw, no offense to any of my guests. They're all great. But I feel like it should be personal. I feel like it should be, if not me, it should be someone who we've all been dying to hear from. You know, it'd be great if like a Michael Chapdelan episode came out, or when I interviewed either Fred or Adam, my old teacher, something like that, something special, something personal. So it might be a little bit, because I'm going to take off here. I was out of town. I was in Guatemala with the girl for 5 days. It was magical. We stayed with this family of Mayans. I don't want to get too much into it, because I don't want to be the guy that bores you with stories of my vacation. And then I immediately went to a wedding about 3 days after I got home from that. So I'm just now settling back in to New York for a little bit. And then on the 20th, I take off to go to California for the holidays. So I will not be focusing on the podcast much this month. I'm sure that that'll be fine with you guys. Like I said, you can go listen to Tony Landman's podcast. You can go listen to some backed up Simon Powis's podcast. He should be coming out with something if he hasn't already. That's an incredible show. And that's it. So as far as what happened during that week between when I went to Guatemala and when I went to the wedding in Missouri last weekend, I ended up forgetting both my mother's birthday, which was on November 30th, and my brother's birthday, his 35th birthday. Rory Williams, the sweetest, the most you could ask for in a brother. I got the two best brothers in the world. Rory, of course, is someone I'm very close to because he lives in New York. He did a real bang-up job on my 40th birthday, made like a big poster. And what do? Well, I'm just so distracted and so selfish that I forgot. I haven't done this before. I think I forgot my mom's birthday once in college. But she's trying to be nice about it, but she was like, do not let it happen again. So I'm kind of in a hole here, and I'm trying to dig my way out. And that's where you guys come in. That's where you can help. All right. Right now, what happens to us music teachers is, I got a little Christmas gig that'll make up a little bit of money. But other than that, there's nothing. December is a very slow month. Unless you got the Christmas gig, some of you guys have that figured out. You got them back to back to back. But everything sort of shuts down, and then you don't teach for, the last week of the month, you're not teaching at all. And in my case, more, a little over a week. So what you have in December is a wonderful cauldron of financial ruin. You aren't working, and yet you are expected to spend more money than you are pretty much at any other time of the year, whether it's on traveling, booze, presents. I've got some nieces and some nephews we got to look out for, and I've got a mother who is being very sweet, but I can tell is burying a cold flame of resentment towards me that I might need to get something for. A brother who I should take out to dinner or some drinks. And I'm not saying I'm going to do any of this because, as you know, I don't call my family when it's their birthday. So I am inherently a horrible and selfish human being. But if you donate to the podcast, maybe you can help me take care of some of these issues. All right. It's the end of the year. I don't know if you can write it off. Ask your local lawyer. But you are donating something to me. I don't have that, whatever it is, the 401 thing. So whatever, if you guys know what that means, that's what that means. I tried to get it, but it just ended up being some scammy crap with a lawyer. You know, some guy sitting there going, well, you know, we work closely. We take a look at you. We pitch your, and I'm just like, where are you? Guy says, I'm in West Virginia. I'm like, oh, great. Okay. So what is this? What is this? This is easily write-offable. You know? But go ahead and write it off or don't write it off, whatever you want to do, but donate to the show. It's the end of the year. All right. You got some extra scratch laying around. You don't want to give it to Uncle Sam? Give it to me and I'll take the consequences myself. All right. I'll figure it out. I could probably use some time in the slammer. It'd be a good life experience. So donate to the show. The way you do that is going to BrettWilliamsMusic.com. Go to BrettWilliamsMusic.com and click on anything, whether it says talk, play, media, anything. You click on anything on the top part of there, and then you're in something called a subpage. You know, when you get taken to like a brand new page with new stuff on it, the podcast page. You go to the right of any of those subpages, and boom, that's it. You donate to the show via PayPal, preferably via Venmo. If you can't do Venmo, do PayPal. I don't care. And I've had some very generous donations this year. It's the end of the year. I want to thank all those people that did that. Everybody who donated, big and small. And in particular, there were some, there were a couple of sizable donations. You know who you are. And if there's anything you need, whether it's a back rub or any sort of service at this point, if anything physical would be fine. It would be my honor to be the apple of your eye. I'm just kidding. I don't want to be a hooker, but it's getting there, folks. So please donate to the show so that I don't have to become a hooker this Christmas to pay for gifts for my mother, you know, while I go on my yearly pilgrimage to California. All right. And that's it. Let's get on with the show. Here is music historian and slide guitar expert, lap steel guitar expert, Paul Warnick and Scott Schwartz.
Yeah, I don't feel like an intellect most days. No, I'm the director of the University of Illinois Sousa Archives and Center for American Music.
So John Philip Sousa.
John Philip Sousa, Stars and Stripes. And, yeah. And yes, my background is in music and ethnomusicology.
Ethnomusicology, but mm-hmm. The band part. Are you a band guy? What was your instrument?
I started out in jazz sax, sang mm-hmm. opera for a long time, and now play classical guitar. Actually, now I'm messing.
What?
Yeah. I believe it or not. Yeah, I love classical guitar.
When did you pick it up?
Actually, I bought a classical guitar when I was doing a tour of Spain. This would be in 78, yeah. And I had mentioned to my mother at that point that, geez, I'm going to be in Spain. It'd be a perfect time to buy a guitar. And she said, no. Guitars lead to sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Wow, and that's entirely true.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but so I went to Spain, and the director of the large ensemble had said, we couldn't buy anything we couldn't put under a seat, and so I bought a Contreras guitar from Contreras in Madrid. Was about an hour and a half late for the bus, so the director was particularly pissed.
Yeah.
And when he saw that I had a classical guitar, he was even angrier. But I hung on to the guitar for the entire trip, and actually just held on to it and took lessons for just a short period of time in college. And then when I was teaching at East Tennessee State University, I was doing a collegium musicum, basically early music ensemble.
Yeah,
and
right.
My gamba player retired.
You were conducting it, directing it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my ensemble. And So I said, okay, fine. Let's see, you know, what it takes to learn the gamba, because we need gamba in the ensemble.
The viola da gamba.
Yep.
So the big, the
thing between the knees.
It's a cello.
Cello. Well, yeah, the cellists and gamba players would clearly argue the extremes. But the bottom line was, I said, basically, it's a guitar bowed. And I said, well, the hell, I don't want to do that. I pull out my guitar. And
is it tuned like a guitar?
Bass. Six strings.
It is six strings.
I didn't
know that. Mm-hmm. See, I don't study enough.
Yeah.
I don't pay attention.
And within a month, was playing the guitar and doing the gamba parts and directing the group. And at that point, it hadn't stopped.
So Darren starts a long career and a long stint in ethnomusicology and other related
disciplines. Well, the ethno stuff was just, you know, that was what my PhD studies were in, you know. But, you know, the guitar was just what helped me through life.
Well, so we have I feel like we have a very academic, and at the same time, I can't believe you wouldn't call yourself an intellectual. You said you have a doctorate?
No, I never finished a dissertation. So, you know, there you go.
So you're still an everyman.
I'm just an everyman. Yeah.
Going on to Paul. Paul is with us too. Now, Paul, are you also a doctor?
No, and I'm sorry that I referred to Scott earlier as Dr. Schwartz. even though he doesn't have that credential, I kind of feel like he does.
Yeah, we're going to call you Dr. Schwartz for the Dr. rest Schwartz. Of
this. Oh, gosh, please stop. I don't even let my students call me that. Just call me Scott.
Hey, Scott. Right. Well, so Scott and Paul. Now, Paul is... Okay, so let me wrap my... This show right now, what we're talking about is an exhibit. We've got a little bit of a background on him. We'll get to the exhibit. Obviously, the exhibit is, what is this thing called?
Well, it's about Lucrezia Candle and her grand litar.
It's a grand litar. The grand litar part of it, the actual physical instrument, I think is where you restored it or something?
Yes, so I...
This is Paul we're talking to now. Mm-hmm.
I did some of the work on it, but a lot of the restoration work to make the amplification section, the speakers, and the light show functional again was done by the good folks at Peterson Strobe Tuners, makers of the world's finest.
So this is an electric guitar that's played on your lap?
No, this is an electric console steel guitar.
So tell me about it. Describe this thing up for the audience then.
How would you describe it, Scott? First of all, we have an electric steel guitar that has actually four necks, but courses of strings.
Now, courses of strings are on a six-string guitar.
Yes,
each course is tuned to a note, and when you double that, like on a 12-string guitar, you have two different strings that are two different sizes, but they both sound the same note.
I think the course concept is maybe getting you off cue.
Am I wrong?
What I'm saying is groups of strings. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Okay, so we have like four groups of strings, which allows basically like having four tunings, because when you're playing a straight steel guitar without pedals, you're limited and you have to do what I've heard called transcending the straight bar. You hold this straight bar in your hand, and it has to go over the frets, and you can't manipulate it like your fingers would move across a fretboard. You're kind of limited to
dragging a bar,
right? Or rolling it slightly for vibrato. You just put this over the fret, and because you don't have your fingers to articulate across more frets in say one position, you have to have different tunings to embellish your major or minor chord, wherever tuned to, like usually most probably sixths, sevenths, ninths, elevenths, and thirteenths. And then having different tunings allows you to play more chords, you know, throughout a song, more complex things. And say you're playing just a simple country song, a 1-4-5 with, you know, three majors and maybe a 5-7 chord. You know, the grand litar with its groupings of strings allowed Lucrezia to play major chords, minor chords, diminished and augmented.
But with just holding her bar over.
From changing from one neck to another, playing here, just moving up and across.
Okay, so let me get this straight. What we have is we have an open tuned guitar times
yes
however many there
yes,
are
yes
times Well, we could. I call it times four, but one of them is actually so split in four.
One of the guitar necks is playing all major chords. One of the guitar necks is playing all minor chords. One of them is playing diminished, and one of them is playing augmented.
That's kind of the way the Grand Littar, the way Latricia set it up, was an A major tuning.
She made it? She built it?
She conceived it in a daydream state, and her father built it in cooperation with National Guitars in Chicago.
Grand Littar.
The Grand Littar. The name Littar was a contraction of Latricia's name, Latricia and guitar, put it together, and you have Littar. Supposedly, the name was coined by Paul Whiteman. He gave it the name of the instrument. Latricia's guitar is the Littar.
Wow. Well, so I interrupted you a little bit to clarify on that, but you're saying, and this is an electric instrument. So it's we're talking about a steel guitar. That's played with the same thing, meaning you're playing it with the little piece of steel that you drag along the strings.
A steel bar, yes.
So instead of playing it with a slide, it's played with a piece of steel.
Well, not like a slide the way a blues player would play a bottleneck slide, wearing on your pinky or your ring finger or something.
You're holding it like a little pencil.
A steel guitar, a round bar or a Stevens bar. She used a Stevens bar, which kind of looks like the cross-section of a railroad track almost.
So you're a steel guitar guy then,
yes,
Paul, right?
Yes, I'm a steel guitar. A pedal steel guitar is my main instrument.
What does the pedal do?
Well, the pedals take the open tuning, and they're devised to either raise or lower the pitches of the strings so you can get chord combinations without moving the bar. In other words, on a standard pedal steel, the most common tuning, which is the E9 tuning, in say, whatever fret I could go to, I can play the one chord, I can play the four chord, I can play the five chord or the 5-7, you could play the two minor, the 6 minor or the 6 major. You can play all those chords by combining pedals without moving the bar at all.
How many pedals are there?
Well, it depends on it. Some guys, the more modern pedal steel, like TC was playing in our demonstration today, will have two necks with 10 strings. Standard complement is like 8 pedals and also knee levers. The knee levers work the same.
That's insane.
I know. Knee levers, they actually operate the same as the floor pedals, which change the pitch of the strings, but you engage them with your knees. Your knee hits the side of them. So this way you could, say, operate, you could push down 2 pedals with your foot, combine 2 pedals, and hit a knee lever. So now you're activating, like, 3 pedals.
And careful not to do them at the same time unless you want to.
Right.
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 But you hear it. Sometimes you hear where it's just like a mess of sound.
That must be
somebody, like, doing 2 things at once.
If you take the chromatics on there and the seventh, sometimes if you were just to strum across it, it might not sound as chordal as if you play certain groups of strings. Okay, so we have certain on a standard. I'm going like E9 tuning now, which is what the Nashville steel players call the money neck. Okay, that's the one that you hear most in country music and stuff. The neck that they play, the most common tuning. You would just use different, you know, triad string grips.
Yeah.
Okay, we know which strings to hit that get, you know, your build on, you know, your tonic and your first inversion and your second inversion of the major, you know, when it's tuned to E.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, you put 2 pedals down, now you go to A, put 1 pedal in an E lever, you know, now you go to B, or with the pedal you go to a B7. 1 pedal down will go to an C-sharp minor.
Yeah.
And the other go to F-sharp minor. So the beauty of it is that because when you're playing a Hawaiian guitar and you're limited by this round bar that you're holding in your hand, it just basically goes over 1 fret at a time. So the concept is adding strings with more notes and then adding the string's ability to change pitch with the pedals and knee levers is what gives you your chord combinations and your note combinations to, you know, play much more versatile, more complex things.
And actually do... Yeah, because that's when you listen. The first guy I listened to was a demon. I think it's Speedy West, right?
Speedy West is one of my heroes. One of the greatest steel
Jimmy
guitar
Bryant
players
used to play.
Jimmy Bryant, right? Two Guitars Country Style was their groundbreaking album on Capitol, and the Stratosphere Boogie. God,
but,
what a tune!
I mean, and just like hearing that, you didn't, because before that, I had sort of only heard it kind of in Dolly Parton movies are backing up Shania Twain. So I was just sort of like, that's that weird sort of, I'm from California, I wasn't into it. So I was like, okay, I don't really, you know, this is that's fine. When I heard him do it, I was like, there's got to be more to this than, because there were leaps happening.
DeRay. Speedy West was probably the first.
Yeah.
He got the first Bigsby guitar, steel guitar with pedals. I mentioned Paul Bigsby here, who was the father of the modern pedal steel, and a man I wish I could have met. I do admire. He came up for Speedy West, was the first.
What was that guy's name? Paul what?
Paul Bigsby.
Paul Bigsby.
Maker of the famous vibrato handle that adorns so many Gibsons and Gretches and Gills.
Is that true?
The Bigsby vibrato handle, yes.
The first vibrato?
Yes.
Before Fender.
The first commercially successful vibrato that could be applied to various makes and models of guitars.
Whammy bar,
right. Yeah. That came after, way back in the day, Rickenbacker came out with something called the Vibrola guitar, which had a motor that vibrated the tailpiece or something. It had a weird vibrato, but it wasn't very successful.
Yeah.
And Bigsby made the first commercially successful vibrato tailpiece, whammy bar handle.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool. So this kind of history, you see, Scott, this is nuts. This is what we, because we kind of jump around in academia, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
So, but as far as like your role in all this, you curate these sort of things for the Kranitz Center. This is not the only thing. You're not just, you're a steel guitar guy.
Right.
All the way.
Right.
And I want to know more I feel like I could talk forever about this. Scott, when you approach something that you're going to, because this thing is a steel guitar without the, I feel like I got to come back to you in a second, because now I want to make it clear what the Letar is.
Right.
The Letar is a four-necked steel guitar that is played instead of using pedals or knee pedals,
right,
you are just straight up going to the next neck and moving along on that open tuning neck.
Yes.
Right.
That being said, what attracted you to this? Because this is obviously something. It's an interesting instrument, but what is it about it that?
Well, let me back up.
Have you done a steel guitar exhibit before?
Yes, I mean, we did. We have the Eddie Elkire Hawaiian guitar collection, who I considered kind of the beginning of Hawaiian guitar. Eddie Elkire. Anybody who's a steel player knows Eddie stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he had no college education. I mean, basically a sixth grade education. Self-taught engineer who was just sharp as a tack and just a math geek who really understood the concepts of electronics and harmonics, and he creates a whole variety of instruments. Well, his son, Dick Elkire, was head of the chemical engineering department here, and he had approached me, and he wanted to bring his father's papers and instruments here, and I had said at the time, you know, we don't have a strong guitar collection, and I suggested that they should go to the National Museum of American History. They have a great guitar collection. And put them in contact with my colleagues there. And they went out and visited and had a great tour after they had gotten a tour of my center and its collections. And when Dick came back, he said, really like what you're doing here more than what they're doing in American History. So we'd like to donate the stuff to you. And then I called my colleague at the Smithsonian and just confirmed, are you guys going to be okay? I had worked there 10 years. And at that point, we agreed that we would connect our collections. So intellectually, the Smithsonian's collection of guitars is tied to our collection, and our collection connects to them.
Yeah.
And it was Jonathan Troutman who came here to do research on our Elkire collection, which he's basically said, we have the largest Hawaiian guitar collection in the country.
Oh, wow.
And he had called me up, and he had said, I know this guy, his name is Paul Warnick, and he's just got Latrizzi Candle stuff, and, you know, I've been talking to him about finding a home for this stuff. And I said, well, I don't know, Paul, but, you know, how about you give me, you know, his phone number, and I'll give him a call. And I did. And then came out to your house, and we looked at the collection. You played the instrument in your garage. And I said, but this is extraordinary. It's a woman from Illinois who, you know, has connections to Eddie Alkire in terms of correspondence, even though she didn't use his technique for teaching. Right. So, in essence, it made very good sense to bring the two collections together. And and we continue to grow them that way.
A slide guitar collection.
Well, yeah.
Steel guitar.
Steel guitar would be that'd be the best way to put it.
What Mr. Alkire is most remembered or known for among us steel guitarists is that he was kind of the pioneer of evolving into a 10-string tuning, mm-hmm. from going from a 6-string instrument to 7 strings had become popular in the mid-30s. People played 6, 7 string, 8. But he expanded onto a 10-string tuning, the Alkire A harps, of which are several mm-hmm. models around collection here, and I've actually owned a number of models of. Mm-hmm. And then his tuning method of teaching. If you strum across an Alkire-tuned A-harp, it's not a chordal tuning in itself. It's like if you strum across, you don't get a nice-sounding chord. It's more like playing like adjacent keys on a piano. Mm-hmm. It's more of a, I don't want to say a diatonic or a modal tuning, but it was meant for playing wider chord grips, possibly sometimes mm-hmm. even with 3-finger picks, in more of a almost a piano or George Shearing piano kind of style, where you're mm-hmm. spreading out the notes mm-hmm. further and you're grabbing the right grips and the right notes to make a chord. Because if you strum them all together, it's mm-hmm. it's kind of dissonant.
Right, and you're arpeggiating.
Yeah,
and you're playing arpeggios. You're breaking up the chord more.
Well, arpeggio is like a tune.
You're playing it more melodic. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, in essence, you know, the bar he used is nearly identical to a standard bar, but it gave him across those 10 strings, he could pick the section of the string he was working with, and then picking out the pitches. So he was notorious for doing radio broadcasts, and he would come up with new tunings, and then he'd broadcast them, and everybody would want to play these new tunes. And he said, not a problem. You need to buy my method books to explain the tunings and how to play it. And you know, literally, every time people would start to lose interest in his technique, he would create another set of tunings, arrange another set of pieces, broadcast them, everybody be juiced up, and then he'd be back selling new arrangements. And that is essentially Eddie's strength. And he was a marketing genius.
Right. Wow. And I think it's because that you have this strong connection here mm-hmm. at the University of Illinois at Champaign to the Eddie Alkire collection, mm-hmm. In your archive that made me think
Where are you, Paul?
Where am I?
Yeah, where are you? Where do you live?
I live in the town of Wilmington, Illinois, on the Kankakee River.
So we're still in Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I've lived in Illinois my life. I was mm-hmm. born and raised in Chicago.
You're a what member?
I was born and raised in Chicago. Oh, okay. I've lived in Illinois all my life.
Okay, cool. What did
you say? I'm an Illinois native.
Oh, okay. All right, great.
But anyway, no, the D'Souza archive here, having the Alkire collection and knowing that there was a strong steel guitar presence and here at this location is one of the reasons why I felt that the donation of the National Grand Litar to here was the appropriate place.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. You donated it.
Yes, mm-hmm. I did.
How did you acquire it?
Well, it's a story we kind of told about in the presentation we did. Mm-hmm. In about the early 80s, I started as a steel guitar player. I had the means to start collecting steel guitars. I was very interested in resonator guitars at the onset, guitars made by National and Dobro prior mm-hmm. to World War II.
So that was the first, that's what got you started with the Dobros, the resonators.
And Nationals, the resonator guitars. And then I started to collect all things steel guitar. In particular, I had the guitars made by the National Company, which moved from Los Angeles in about 1934, winter 34, to Chicago, and then merged with Regal Dobro Corporation, and afterwards became Valco. All the Valco made instruments by Nationals and Supros. So I first obtained
all these like consumer class instruments.
Yes. Yes, but yeah. This one is not. Mm-mm. So what happened was, early on, I got Tom Wheeler's book, American Guitars, which has been reprinted several times and is now out of print. And in the national section, it showed one of the pictures we have of Letty. Latricia, I'm sorry, she's always called her Letty.
Letty.
Yeah, Letty is her nickname, her friends call her. I call her Letty.
Now, when was she around, though?
She was born in 1915 and she died in
2010.
Okay, go on and we'll go back to that.
I saw in the national section of the book, there's a picture of her with the Grand Latar. It says, teacher Latricia Campbell poses with the National Grand Latar steel guitar. And I looked at this picture so many times, I never knew what it was, because there's no resemblance to any standard-looking steel guitar, whether lap or console model. I had, at the time, no idea that it had a built-in amplifier, speakers, a light show, the immensity of what it did. I had no idea from this black-and-white photo in American Guitars book. So, what happened come to pass, and being a national collector down the line, I bought a national lap steel, I don't remember from who, but there was a receipt, an original receipt for the guitar in the case, and it said it was from the Modern Guitar Studios, 306 South Wabash, Chicago, to the young man in Chicago who bought the guitar, and it was signed by Latricia Campbell. So yeah. I was like, wow, now I know. She was a teacher in Chicago at this place down on South Wabash. You know, it's now Jewelers Row down there. It used to be like the Music Row in the Kimball Building. So I had that clue, but it wasn't until later when I went to the, I was a member of the Hawaiian Steel Guitar Association, they used to have, up until a few years ago, their annual convention and performance and in Joliet at a hotel there. I met a lady named Kay Koster. And she saw me with the National Lap Steel. We started talking, and she told me how she was a teacher, and she sold many of these National guitars. And I asked her, have you ever heard of Latricia Campbell? She says, she was my teacher.
Oh, my God.
I said, wow. I assume she's passed on by now. I mean, I'm talking to Kay. This lady's in her 90s now.
Right.
Okay. Kay Koster, she lived to be 95, passed away a few years ago. She said, no, she's still alive. And she told me her married name. Latricia Campbell Lay, L-A-Y is her last name.
Yeah.
So, and she told me where she lived, but I didn't have much more information, her address or phone number, so me being a veteran of the police department, I did my own little investigation, and I...
Did all this happen, all this collecting and stuff started when you were still a cop, but now you are a retired?
Yeah, I'm retired.
Officer?
I'm retired emergency telecommunicator, 911 operator,
okay.
Community service officer. Not a street cop. I don't put the bracelets on people. I'm glad I didn't have to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, slam the cell door on some people, but I don't like busted people. That's not my thing. Yeah. But anyway, so...
You don't got to be afraid of Officer Warnick.
No, don't be afraid of Officer Warnick. Don't call me sir, please. I had so much of that. It's AU. Anyway, we...
Scott and Paul.
I got enough information from this lady... wonderful lady, Kate Costner, wonderful Hawaiian player, wonderful guitar player, teacher of many students in the Rockford area, many guitar competitions. She gave me the information on Latricia. I hunted her down. I called her up on the phone, said, Miss Campbell or Miss Lay, said, you don't know me. I give her my name. I said, I'm a steel guitar player, collector, historian. I want to talk to you about your story. And she was just shocked that anybody even cared. And when I told her how I came about to knowing about her, she had no idea that she was in the American Guitars book by Wheeler, which is like the first Bible for guitar collectors.
Yeah.
And she had no idea that anyone would even care at this point about what she did. So we forged this friendship, and she became to be in the few year, two years maybe that I knew her, like my adopted second mother. I loved her very much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A wonderful woman.
That's so you I mean, and I think that's the thing, is that a lot of these things, and you guys have a relationship too.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these things are really about the people you build the relationships with. And if you meet people you like and you want to be around, that's the instrument you're going to present. You know, or that's the instrument you're going to go
and
further with, and you're going to, and so she, you know.
She made it a present to me. She donated
right.
the instrument. I was shocked to know that after I found out that she still had the Grand Latar, was in its huge case under the stairs in her basement, had not seen the light of day since 1955. and we're talking now, this was in 2009, right?
Oh, 2008 is when you first... 2008,
okay. Yeah. Up until then, the thing was sitting there, had, you know, started to deteriorate some of the electronics and connections and things. And she said she wanted to give it to me because she felt that if she had left it to her family, that it would wind up in a dumpster, and that would have been an awful shame.
I mean, it's just a, it's a fascinating story, and the exhibit is going on for how long is it? How's it going?
Well, the exhibit is for the Guitar Festival right now.
So it's over when the Guitar Festival.
Well, no, not correct. We're going to reopen it in November in the University Library Marshall Gallery. We won't have the instruments out, but the photographs and paper records, and there's some other things that I couldn't put in this exhibit. To basically give people more opportunity to see the history and legacy of this wonderful Midwest steel player.
It's so important that we do this at this festival because you have so many people coming from all over the place that it's important that we celebrate where we are right now within a, I'm assuming, 50-mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. And what the kind of things that happen locally, which is what the festival's all about. I talked to Mike about that.
Mm-hmm.
Festival's all about bringing together the regional with the international, and so you know, and celebrating them both almost on an equal plane, you know, or as much as possible.
I mean, we've talked about, you know, the objects and the paper records,
right.
But you know, in the end, you know, I tell all my archives students, it's about the people, and quite frankly, that's the part I enjoy most about the work is, you know, meeting the people. In this instance, I was not able to meet Letty, but no. I met her through you, Paul.
Right, and I'm sure she would be proud to know you and what's going on here. And the one story which I forgot to tell at our presentation, when I was speaking about Kay Koster, is to the this woman's virtuosity is that she could read and write out scores. I mean, we're talking orchestral scores, the grand staff. She could read all the parts, even the drums. And one thing, interesting story, the two interesting stories, actually, if we have time for this, I'll tell you two interesting stories about Letitia.
We have a little bit of time. I actually, you know what my problem is? I've got one big issue.
Okay.
And, you know, if you don't mind me trying to figure this out, I want you to tell the story to the listeners. My parking is ending in 7 minutes. So I'm going to try. It says no internet connection. Oh, that's okay. So I might be able to figure this out. But I'm going to have to listen and renew my parking. And also, I have not heard more noise all day. But all of a sudden, we are right next to the grand thoroughfare of the entire thing. So you can see these people coming and going. There's elevators. I'm sure they're not going to mind. But I'm just going to see if I can extend this parking. But please.
Yeah. Tell your story, Paul.
Okay,
the first quick story
comes to me via Kay Koster. Was at her music lesson with Letty downtown at the guitar studio. She said, all of a sudden, in a rush, this guy comes in. Letty, I got to talk to you. I got a problem. Well, the person who came running in was a famous drummer, Gene Krupa. Gene Krupa had a problem with one of his arrangements. And he came to Letty, said, can you help me out? So Letty stopped her lesson with Kay and went over with Gene, and she started thumbing through his manuscript, grand staff, orchestral arrangement, blah, blah, page 1, 2, she thumbed through. Here's the problem. She found a problem for it, penciled in all the corrections, and sent him on his way. Thanks, Letty. And Krupa took off. The second interesting story with another famous musician is when Letitia brought the National Grand Litar, was brought to the Music Trades Show in New York, 1937, which we are celebrating the 80th anniversary of that and the Grand Litar's building this year. She was demonstrating the Grand Litar in the room when none other than her idol and the most famous steel guitarist of the day, Alvino Ray, came in. And Letty was like a little bit taken aback. She told me she could not stop her performance. She had to keep playing. She saw Alvino was there. When she finished playing, she looked up and Alvino was gone. And she was crushed. She was hoping she was going to meet her idol. So the speculation has been hashed out and still got her form. What would make Alvino Ray leave so suddenly after seeing such an instrument? And the only thing is we could think of is that he was kind of shocked or bamboozled at because at the time he was working with Gibson and they're building just like double neck lap steels, and now he's seeing a guitar by National that's got four necks, a light show, built-in amplification. This is way beyond anything he's doing with Gibson.
Built-in amplification.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. Well, I can't wait to take a look at it, guys. I haven't even seen it yet.
Oh, dang. Well, then you got to get up there and check it out.
I will get up there and check it out after I get my car. And make sure that I don't get a ticket in a town I don't live in because I'm not going to pay it.
Well, that's okay. It's just New York.
I think the statute of limitations is it should be 2 years because I'll be back here next time to look at whatever else you guys throw together. I love it. I can't wait to see it. Thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thanks,
Scott
Brett.
Schwartz and Paul Warnick with the
Grand Latar.
Grand Latar.
Yes.
Oh, Latricia candle.
That's right.
Yeah, don't forget Latricia.
Latricia candle. She's the inventor.
Yes.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks for joining me. I'm sorry about all the distractions. I hope it wasn't so bad.
No. There wasn't even cussing.
Being next to... There wasn't cussing, but being next to a parking garage has its charms.
That does it for the show, folks. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy New Year. I really appreciate you guys sticking with me for 99 episodes. It's been a humbling experience. I really, really sincerely appreciate it. So be safe, be warm, give my love to your families, and happy holidays, everyone.